Revolutionary by necessity.
Prisoner turned president.
Free in many ways that he wasn't before. And Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Polar Levine, Polarity One, on Progressive, the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. This is News Dissector Radio honoring Nelson Mandela as we speak here in New York. Thousands and thousands of South Africans have lined up in Pretoria to go pass by his coffin and pay their final respects to him. 2 days ago, over 150 leaders from around the world came to South Africa for a memorial, which went on and on and on, including President Obama, but many other presidents as well, paying tribute to Mandela. Now it's the South African people who finally get their chance, and they've really astounded the government because they didn't expect quite the scale and size of the reaction of people who are, in a sense, paying tribute to him with their bodies, with their, you know, patience, standing in line the way many South Africans did in 1994 as they waited for their first opportunity to vote. And so as the world says goodbye to Mandela today on this program, we're going to try to talk a little bit, not just about him, but about the movement in this country that helped put pressure on our government and on the world to change U.S. support for South Africa to try to bring about a different approach in our foreign policy. And joining me, no one person that I can think of is a better choice of someone to join me on this is my friend, my comrade, my colleague, Prexy Nesbitt from Chicago, who's been a stalwart, as they say, in the anti-apartheid struggle, but the struggle of people supporting the peoples of Southern Africa in their fight for justice and against colonialism. Prexy teaches a course at Columbia College in Chicago about Nelson Mandela. And so he's standing by. But before we get going in our conversation with Prexy, I want you to remember this song, which did so much to spark activism in that period in the late 80s as the world waited for Mandela. Rexy Nesbitt, as you listen to that song, Free Nelson Mandela, and you think about your long walk to freedom alongside Mandela in the fight against apartheid, what comes to mind?
Danny, it's great to be on this show with you. What comes to mind first for me is probably an illegal trip that I made to South Africa, to the Transkei in 1983, just after I'd been working with the World Council of Churches program to combat racism. And in that trip, we were doing seminars and training of people, and it was very difficult circumstance. We had to talk often late at night on the roads in the dark, walking along. People kept saying to me, if only you could talk to the old man, if only you could talk to the old man. And I kept thinking this was Mandela, and I couldn't understand. How could they possibly be saying this? But in fact, what I learned later was that they wanted me to talk to a wonderful man by the name of Beyers Naudé, who was one of the leading clerics in South Africa, very outspoken. I know you know him. And he was one of the great leaders of that struggle, a name that many people haven't heard about.
And hasn't been referenced recently. Of course, he was with the Dutch Reformed Church, white, Afrikaner, but principled, stand-up, righteous, you know, minister who stood with the people of South Africa, you know, right to the end. His son is named Doom, and I sent him a condolence when his father passed away. He was one of definitely the great leaders, and it was also an indication of what many of us don't recognize, is that this was a struggle that was non-racial at its core, was unifying people from churches, from labor, from community groups across the spectrum, an alliance of politics between organizations and activists of all kinds. And I think we tend to view it all today as if Nelson Mandela personally was in charge of everything. He wasn't, was he?
No, he wasn't. I think that's it's a sad thing, and I hope it'll change as more Americans begin to learn more of the details. And he would be the first to say that. I remember him being on one time the Oprah Winfrey show, and I happened to be there, and Oprah kept saying to him, "Oh, I love you. You are so great. You are my hero, da, da, da." And Madiba just kept saying to her, "I am a member of the African National Congress. Along with many comrades, I have been engaged in the struggle to free South Africa."
Well, you know, our media has a tendency to make celebrities out of certain individuals and to give them an inordinate amount of attention. We're seeing this with Mandela. On the one hand, he deserves to be celebrated for his long service to the struggle there. On the other hand, as you point out, he never claimed that he was waving a magic wand to bring about change in South Africa. And in a way, that's a media narrative of the great man of history, you know, that history
is
made by people at the top, a couple of really important people do everything. And in fact, this was the people of South Africa who brought this change about through their own sacrifice. Many of them died. Many of them were tortured. Many of them were in prison. Mandela wasn't the only one who suffered a family breakup, who suffered the kind of treatment that he did. And he nevertheless was able to become a symbol and a stand-up substitute for so many others. And he never was not conscious of that. You know, I met him on several occasions, spoke to him about this. He was very insistent. He was embarrassed, really, by the kind of attention that he was given, as if he was Jesus reborn kind of thing.
Yeah, you know that great ending to that film you did, Danny, Mandela in America. I'll never forget that ending. It's when he's standing in his film saying, "It's not the kings and the presidents who make history, but the ordinary masses of the ordinary people." It's a great expression.
So, you know, this is what we're in a way up against and want to try to contextualize, is to understand what's going on. Obviously, this has been a massive story. You know, I wrote a book, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. We had our launch party for the book last Monday, and on Thursday he was gone, right? A minute before we went on the air here on PRN-FM, and we devoted the whole show to talking about him at a time when, you know, we hadn't really prepared anything. But, you know, I guess our lives prepared us for it. We expected it. But still, when it happens, it's hard to deal with.
That's right.
And, you know, people, though, you must say that this person, his story, in a way, the new movie about him, the television shows about him, the news programs about him, and the support that he received from so many people around the world is a sign that people want, you know, people they can believe in as leaders. They want people of integrity. They want people who are willing to fight for them and with them and not just be deified, you know, as you know, kind of the leaders. I think one of the reasons Obama and Clinton before him were so, you know, taken with Mandela is because they could never become a Mandela.
That's right. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think the other thing is that it's particularly evident in communities in this country where there is particularly oppressed communities, communities of color, whether the working class, white people, communities of color, there's such a thirst to have people who you can trust, people who you can, and that's one of the reasons that there's such an embrace of Mandela in this country.
I was
is
with
that he gave that impression of being, and he, it was by the little things that he did, walking into a room and a child says, "I didn't get to dance for you." I saw this happen in Harare, Zimbabwe, and he had the whole crowd at the stadium go back into the stadium so that these children who had been crying could dance the dance that they had prepared for 2 weeks for him. This is something I think that's one of the characteristics of great leaders, this ability to make people feel like they really matter.
You see, one of the problems in this memorial process with all the presidents lining up to say their, you know, 3 minutes or whatever, and all the, you know, focus on an interpreter who wasn't an interpreter or a, you know, the handshake between Obama
right.
and Raul Castro, which certainly was long overdue. It just seems to me lost in it all. You know, is really the character of the struggle in South Africa and in Southern Africa for freedom. And I believe that what we need to do, in a sense, is to offer a kind of counterpoint to that, a counter narrative to try to explain this. Because what I find, many people, even young people in South Africa, they really don't know much about it. They're not educated about it. They're not really taught about it. They have a very, you know, simplistic view of how things changed. And I guess this has always been true, the so-called Born Frees. That's the group born after
right.
the liberation. But when you talk to them, why, you know, what happened here? Who is who? They really don't know. Okay. And they need to know. We need to do more to educate people, not only about Mandela, but the values that he was part of, the struggle that he led, and the various activists who were part of this, who were not getting the attention they deserve. People like you, Prexy, who were out there in the cold and the, you know, snow of Chicago, who you know, kind of worked on this struggle, who took Americans to Southern Africa to see for themselves, to Mozambique, to South Africa, and helped inform them by participating in this, not just by reading a newspaper about it or watching a documentary.
No, I agree entirely. And I think one of the groups of people that is the most, not this evening in my class, I'm intending to talk at a great length about Albertina Sisulu. I'm going to give members of my class a copy of a speech that Grasa Michel delivered on Madiba's behalf to the memorial service for the great Albertina Sisulu.
Let's just tell our listeners who she was. She was the wife of Walter Sisulu, who was one of the prisoners on Robben Island, was one of the leaders of the ANC, was the person who probably recruited Nelson Mandela into the ANC.
And that's right.
And Albertina Sisulu, when her husband was in prison, became a leader in her own right of the United Democratic Front, was a force, a major force for change. Winnie Mandela may have gotten a lot of the publicity, but inside South Africa, I think Albertina Sisulu got a lot of the credit for holding the movement together. And Gracia Machel, who you just mentioned, was Nelson Mandela's third wife, but before that was the wife of Samora Machel, the president of Mozambique, who died in a suspicious plane crash, who was one of the liberation lions of the struggle in Mozambique. And so, who I met, I was privileged to meet. I think you did as well. Gracia Machel, brilliant, brilliant woman who, has been at Nelson Mandela's side for 18 years, basically nurturing him through this, health crisis that he's finally lost.
And we shouldn't forget about Gracia, Danny, that Gracia was the first Minister of Education of the Free Mozambique, starting right after the independence in 1974, and she did the pivotal study for the United Nations on child soldiers. She's really the world's foremost authority on both recognizing child soldiers and on what to do with trying to rehabilitate them after you get them out of these situations where these 12 and 13-year-olds have been turned into killing machines. I think that one of the things about Gracia, too, that people don't know is that this is a woman who functioned without hesitation in 8 to 10 different languages, all at which she would just eloquent and always would just apologize that she didn't do well enough in such and such a language.
I recently met her daughter, Josie, here in in New York, and she's an amazing person in her own right. So, this is a force for change and someone who, we need to know these names. We need to know Mandela, of course, but these other people as well. Joining us on the phone, Prexy, is my colleague, Stuart Sender, who worked with us on South Africa Now, and who we got into South Africa to cover the release of Nelson Mandela, to have somebody on the ground when all of this happened. And in a sense, our program was virtually banned. It wasn't shown in South Africa. The people, the authorities there were very hostile to us. We could see it in New York on public television. We had to fight to get it seen on many public television stations. But Stuart was on the ground there. And Stuart, when you heard about Nelson Mandela's passing, I'm sure you flashed on the moment that you first laid eyes on him, because you were among the first people to see him, who outside of kind of government negotiators and ANC leaders, to see him coming through and out of that prison.
Dan, it's really nice to be with you. And, it's kind of this extraordinary celebration coupled with, some real sadness and some nostalgia. And, I did flash back to that day, which was a really chaotic and intense and powerful day, and remembered people waiting for hours and hours on that square in Cape Town. And when Nelson Mandela finally appeared, it was just the most extraordinary thing. I did something a little bit a la News.Sector just now. And I just did a quick Google search for Nelson Mandela today. There's 2,650,000 hits on Google.
How
and
many?
That was a day.
2 billion, you're saying.
And that was a day where there hadn't been an image of Nelson Mandela in 27 years. And so the transformation, the power of what he's, kind of elicited, and I got to hear a couple of minutes of your conversation with Prexy before you introduced me, and I think that kind of paradox of the power of who this man is and the way that he became the symbol of the revolution, of all of those people who were waiting for him, so many who gave their lives, their careers, their families, who took great risks that we were able to cover when we did the South Africa Now program, you know, now starting almost 25 years ago, when there were no images at all of Nelson Mandela on television screens around the world.
You know, Stuart, by the way, we're going to be on here till 6. If you want to stay with us, Prexy, please do. This conversation will continue. I just wanted to point to one event, Stuart, that I wasn't there. You were there. Of course, we covered it. We did a documentary that aired the night on PBS Nationwide of his release. It was the only nationwide documentary we did for PBS. And you reported on, you know, what was going on there that day. But now I've had a chance to go back and find out what else was happening at that same time. It's a really fascinating set of stories in my book. It's the chapter called Waiting, People Waiting for Mandela and Waiting on That Day, and the people who were with him that day in the prison, who came out of that house that he was staying in the prison, and how Mandela himself, you know, walks through the gates, and all of a sudden he turns and he walks back a step because these sound men had these sound, you know, kind of microphones, you know, on poles, and he thought he was going to be shot, okay, because he had never seen one before. And so I tell the whole story of what happened on that day, reconstructing it. It's a fascinating story about how he drove to Cape Town and he got lost. The people with him, who the leaders of the movement, lost him. Thabo Mbeki told me that the ANC missed a message from the old government about when he was going to be released. So there was nobody from the ANC there to even greet him officially. So it's an interesting story. But one of the things that happened, I was working with this movie, Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, and they recreated that day exactly, you know, to using all the photographs of that moment, the video and all that, to make it appear as authentic as possible. And I stood there and I really, you know, began to cry almost. You know, I couldn't believe that it felt so real. It was exactly at the same time that he stepped out of the gates and put his fist up with Winnie Mandela. You know, it was a historic moment that almost everyone in the world saw, which is a quite an amazing event. So Mandela became imprinted in people's consciousness, and the fact that the more militant he was, the more he was respected. Obviously, he made and had to make, you know, serious compromises, and that's one of the issues that's being debated in South Africa now. But I think that moment was a triumph for people all over the world who had fought for justice, for people who all over the world had fought for human rights.
And it was a big surprise to people, too. It was an incredible surprise. I think that there are very few people. I remember being out in Madison, Wisconsin, and on a radio show that day, and somebody walked in and said, they just released Nelson Mandela. And we literally turned to televisions while we were on the radio.
Something happened here?
I think we may have just lost Prexy.
Can you try Prexy back? Stuart, you were there. What was the sense of the crowd waiting for him? I mean, it was almost a religious experience.
Well, it really was, Danny. I mean, it was hours, I think, as you know, because there was this confusion and the motorcade got lost. And it was, I think, a delay of something like 6 hours. And the crowd just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, I remember there were people standing all day long, but nobody moved an inch.
One of the great stories that I heard was how this woman had flown from Johannesburg to Cape Town, and she got there, and they said, don't bother going downtown. Don't go to the city hall where Mandela is supposed to be. It's too crowded. It's too dangerous. Go home. You know, and she said, oh, you know, I've come all this way to see him, and now I'm not going to be able to see him. And she goes to her house, and suddenly Mandela knocks on the door. You know, he's been lost. He's trying to find a home of an activist. And so he ended up sitting there taking his shoes off and holding her babies, you know, babies. He hadn't held babies in a long time. So this was quite a remarkable surprise and moment, if you will. And the people who were responsible for organizing all of this, you know, didn't know where he was. It was a you know, kind of creative chaos. But out of it, he did get to make his speech, and he did get to come to Cape Town. He did all the events that followed. The, you know, none of it was really had to come out this way. It could have resulted in a very bloody race-type war there. I mean, it's not, you know, you can't rule out the potential for tremendous violence there. And his cool, his approach to try to include as many people as stakeholders in a negotiating process, I think, prevailed in the end and managed to avert that violence. But it was certainly a very tense situation. There had been violence in Cape Town right before he came there. You know, people were, you know, guns went off, et cetera, and so forth.
You know, I would say, Danny, that one of the memories I have of getting to be a kind of fly on the wall and in the middle of that first day of Mandela's release was there was also some confusion about where the first press conference would be held. And would Mandela be going back to Soweto right away, or would he be staying in Cape Town? And I think Archbishop Tutu really kind of prevailed on him, because he'd been in Cape Town for so long, to come to the Archbishop's residence and hold the first press conference in Cape Town. And there were some journalists who got the news wrong and were quite upset and were flying back to Soweto. And there were a few of us who were kind of aware that this was the first time anything like this had happened. And we, you know, kind of make sure that he was standing in the right place for the camera light and that the sun wouldn't be in his eyes.
It was amazing. You know, people in South Africa didn't get television until 1976. He had no experience with television, and yet he sort of stepped up to the plate like a total media pro.
And that was the thing, right? It was like, not only did he give that speech, you know, moments after coming out of prison, but then stepped up, and I remember this row of cameras, and I remember him just kind of stepping in and starting to answer these questions from this place that was so deep and, you know, and at the same time watching him connect with people.
Well,
it was very, very powerful.
So,
to be a part of that.
You know, Prexy, as the, I think we're going to go out for a few minutes. We have to take a break in a minute or two, but just a comment, Prexy, from you about the memorials that are going on. We had a big one here at the Riverside Church in New York last night. It went on for about 3 hours with all these preachers competing with each other for who had the best sermon. It was very powerful, you know, very lofty rhetoric, and there was a vibe there, you know, a community vibe of people who admired Mandela and have been sort of involved in this over the years.
Well, you know, Danny, I think that's one of the things that I don't know who has the count on that. I mean, I know of 4 different memorials going on here tomorrow and some on Sunday in Chicago. I'm headed to Los Angeles shortly this evening. I mean, tomorrow morning there's going to be memorials out there. There's memorials in San Francisco and Seattle. I mean, who has the count on the numbers of memorials? It's all people's desire to sort of keep a connection with him as long as they can.
And what is it about him, do you think, that inspires this, you know, total devotion, in a sense, that we're seeing? It's not, you know, like it is for most politicians.
No, I think it's partly, it's his steadfastness, certainly. It's his lack of bitterness, as they say, and the media loves to dwell on that. But I think it's just as much his steadfastness and his clarity about many more issues beyond South Africa. I mean, the clarity, I remember so vividly that moment with Ted Koppel, when he silenced Ted Koppel talking about the question of being loyal to your friends, when Koppel was raising his relationship with Gaddafi and Fidel Castro. It's just amazing how much lack of information there is out there. And I think that many Americans also thirst for just knowing much, much more about this great figure and about the time that he's lived in.
Well, that's why I've written that book, Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. It's in stores now. If you're interested, at least you get, you know, kind of my take on this and my background, which goes back many, many years in South Africa on covering all of this. We're going to come back in a few minutes, but we thought we'd take a pause and share South Africa's national anthem with our listeners.
Wonderful.
I think it's one of the greatest protest songs of all time. Stephen Van Zandt's Sun City, and kind of play Sun City. Really, it became the anthem of the anti-apartheid movement. It was a global hit. It had a big fight in the United States to get on the air. Black radio said it was too white. White radio said it was too black. You know, it ran up against the apartheid in our own culture. But nevertheless, it had a tremendous resonance. And then when Jonathan Demme's video hit MTV, it became number one. And it had a tremendous impact in terms of galvanizing people at the grassroots to get involved in the fight for economic sanctions and to overturn a veto by Ronald Reagan, who tried to stop the sanctions movement and failed when his own members of his own party voted to overturn his veto. So, you know, this activism at the base, you know, a case sparked by Sun City, sparked by many other things, I think made a big contribution. Agree or not?
No, I'd like to jump in for a second and just, you know, just a little bit of background on the Sun, on the Sun City thing. Sun City was, a resort, a whites-only resort.
No, it wasn't white. It was actually integrated to It was a gambling casino, basically.
Yeah, and a lot of American musicians would play there, and because of the degree with which it was segregated, the movement that Little Steven and yourself helped launch, the Ain't Gonna Play Sun City thing, was resistance for American artists to not play there until apartheid is gone.
And it was also what many Americans didn't understand, I think. You agree with me on this, Prexy, you know, that forced relocation, these phony homelands that South Africa had created were part of the whole apartheid system. And Sun City called attention to that. It wasn't just about discrimination. It was about people forcibly removed from their homes and forced to live in areas where they could barely survive. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that... you know, one of the reasons that this movement came about, 58 artists, Bruce Springsteen, Bono, Miles Davis, The Temptations. I mean, it was a who's who of socially concerned artists, Bob Dylan and others who were part of this whole Sun City movement. And I think what we see here is cultural politics, not just traditional lobbying politics. Prexy, agree, or are you there?
All right. I'm not sure if I'm... Am I hooked up?
Yes, you are. We hear you now.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I totally agree with that. And I have, had the great occasion to talk with Bonnie Raitt about that and several other people. And, of course, that great moment when Miles Davis comes in there and does that great moment in the video where he's playing there in the studio. It was a decisive moment in the mobilization of people in the anti-apartheid struggle. It resonated all the way out in Kansas, where I was at that time trying to make sure that that key state's senators, Dole and Kassenbaum, would toe the line and keep on voting to overthrow Reagan's veto.
So, that was quite a moment. Actually, I don't know if you know this story. I told it on WBUR in Boston. There's a show called Here and Now. We're going to listen to a little bit of that show in a minute, where little Stephen and I kind of got hooked up again to talk about the impact that Sun City had. We're going to let you hear a little bit of that. It's on WBUR from WBUR in Boston and also on NPR stations around the country. But I told a story there. I don't know if we'll get to this again. If we do, forgive me. But, the artists wanted Miles Davis to be on this, okay? But they were afraid to call him because he had a reputation of being extremely, curt, difficult to deal with, easily agitated the like. And none of them wanted to take him on, So I got the responsibility to call up Miles Davis, okay? Got a number for him. And I called him up and I told him what we were doing. And his, would he come on, And his response was, when do you want me? I said, when do you think you could do it? And he said, how about now? And literally came over there in 15 minutes. Bonnie Raitt was standing by to do, her contribution to the Sun City record. She had to, step over to the side. And Miles came in and just was brilliant, So this is the kind of energy that the Sun City record and sparked, and the role of artists in fighting for a cultural boycott of South Africa as part of the sanctions movement was extremely popular and extremely well supported. There was a controversy about Paul Simon, doing Graceland in the middle of all this and breaking the cultural boycott. And Simon, took a few shots at Sun City. Stephen didn't fire back, but the other day he did. He was very upset because he also, basically said to me, when he talked with Paul Simon, told him that he had been talking to his friend, Henry Kissinger. Listen to this. And that Kissinger told him Mandela was a communist. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So this is part of the backstory that people don't know about. But
somebody needs to write that whole story up.
Yeah, absolutely. But have a listen a little bit to this program Here and Now that was on the NPR. Robin Young is the host, the great television personality turned radio host. And we're going to play a little of this for you and hopefully get to the part where little Stephen is speaking too.
The name of Nelson Mandela wouldn't be well known outside South Africa until the 1980s. It was activist Stephen Biko, who died in police custody in South Africa, who first inspired song from Tom Paxton and in 1980, Peter Gabriel. Also in 1980, the UN established a cultural boycott against South Africa. Then in 1984 came Special AKA's Free Nelson Mandela. Also in 1984, Bruce Springsteen band member Steven Van Zandt and then ABC News producer Danny Schechter teamed up. The result? Sun City. Sun City was a scathing indictment of the luxurious whites-only casino resort, a song written by Van Zandt and recorded by Artists United Against Apartheid. You want to hear more about the song and the history? Danny Schechter, known as the news dissector at rock station WBCN here in Boston, journalist and creator of the show South Africa Now. His new book about Mandela is Mandiba A to Z. He joins us. Danny, welcome.
Pleasure.
And with you, Stephen Van Zandt, E Street Band guitarist, actor, of course, in The Sopranos, and activist. Stephen, welcome to you as well.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, let's start with you. What inspired the song?
Well, I had been doing research on American foreign policy since World War II and left the E Street Band to do that for 10 years or so. And South Africa was on my list of engagements we were involved with, which I felt our government was on the wrong side of. I had heard Peter Gabriel's Biko, which was just a terrific inspiration. I would later discover Gil Scott-Heron's Johannesburg.
Somebody say, what's the word?
It's incredible, if I can jump in. Stephen's perspective was not just a perspective, apartheid is bad, this is a racial problem like the American South. No, his perspective was really framed in the context of the relocation of Native peoples in our country. And one of the central ideas of Sun City was forced relocation. And so the song went much deeper than simply opposing the government of the day. It really tried to explain what the system was.
Well, Danny, explain a little more about that, because Sun City was this resort in the middle of what the South African regime called free states, where they relocated blacks.
Well, Sun City is a resort, a big hotel complex, but it was in a place called Bophuthatswana, which was a homeland of South Africa. South Africa created these fictional homelands that were really controlled by the people in Pretoria, but to the rest of the world, they appeared to be independent states. And in a sense, this was part of the whole plan there, which was to separate people according to their nationalities, their ethnicities, and their backgrounds. And so opposing the homeland system was a central attack on apartheid. Nobody here was really talking about until Stephen came along with Sun City.
The idea was to bring the native African black people out of South Africa proper into these phony homelands and then declare them as independent countries and then bring the black workers back as immigrant labor. At that point, declaring South Africa a democracy. I mean, it was as brilliant as it was evil, and as Danny suggests, it was based on our Indian reservation policy.
Well, yeah. And I know, Danny, initially you wanted Stephen to include in the song artists who had played at Sun City to shame them, but that didn't happen. But you, Stephen, invited all sorts of artists to sing with you on it.
I spoke with some of them who had gone there, and you know, and they had been fooled, you know, and so we gave everybody the benefit of the doubt, because there was a lot of publicity and marketing to get people to go, pretending it was a separate country.
What we wanted to do is break down the apartheid in music in our own country by having musicians, international artists, rap, rock, Motown, jazz, that were usually segregated in America. You know, there would be a black station, a white station, a jazz station, and the like, and put all of these currents on one album as a united statement against apartheid. 58 stars agreed to be part of it. And the fact is, many more wanted to be part of it when they found out about it. There were no more lines for them to sing.
And it was a bit controversial at the time, you know. We crossed that line from social concerns, you know, everybody was fine with feeding people and all that. But first, you know, we named Ronald Reagan by name at the time, at the height of his popularity, which, you know, was a quite a controversial thing at the time.
Some stations wouldn't play Sun City because of, I think, the line that Joey Ramone sang about Ronald Reagan. And to remind ourselves, this is when Ronald Reagan was fighting members of his own party. He was against any sanctions. Let's listen to that line that some stations said, you know, was a deal breaker, wouldn't play the song. Jonathan Demme eventually made a video. You also had a hard time getting that on television stations initially. I want to pick up on, Stephen, something you just said, and let's just touch on this. One artist who did famously recorded in South Africa during the boycott was Paul Simon. He made part of the Graceland album there. And he still defends it to this day. He says to the ANC, which, you know, many South Africans were unhappy that he came, he says, is this the kind of government you're going to be? You're going to tell me what I, you know, tell artists what they can do? He believed, in essence, that art and politics should be kept separate. And his defenders include Philip Glass, Paul McCartney, Oprah. They all appear in a documentary. And they say, you know, without him, Ladysmith, Black Mambazo wouldn't be known. There would be no human face on apartheid. That was a huge debate at the time. And it still lingers.
Yeah. Where to begin with this? Well, first of all, I was trying to, even when I was down there, I was trying to defend him, actually. I met with some very serious people, called the Azanian People's Organization, ZAPU, and he was on a hit list, okay? You know, they're going to kill him, you know, and I insisted on him being taken off this list. I then spoke to the UN about having him taken off the UN list, the blacklist. You know, having said that, you know, he gave me that line, you know, that art transcends politics. And I said, Paul, all due respect, but not only does art not transcend politics, but art is politics. So we agreed to disagree at the time. By now, I would have thought he would, you know, have a little bit of a mea culpa. But not poorly, no.
We'll leave it at that. Stephen Van Zandt, Danny Schechter on the 80s protest song, Sun City. You're listening to Here and Now.
Well, I thought I'd share a little snatch of that with you, Prexy. And Stuart, are you still here?
Danny, you know, there's a backstory that you may not know. Paul Simon came out here to Chicago with members of Ladysmith, and the ANC contacted me. And they asked me to put together a picket line to protest Paul Simon. And we were outside doing the picketing when I got a message from Hugh Masekela, who had by that time joined up with Paul Simon. And Hugh asked me to suspend the picketing and come in and meet and talk with Paul Simon about these different opinions that we had. Well, we did do that at Hughes. He was senior in the structure of the ANC. So it was a real messy situation, that whole Paul Simon saga. And really, I'm so glad to hear this other information about the whole story.
You know, it was a divisive move. It was an arrogant put himself first kind of move.
Right.
He justified it because he paid double wages to the South African musicians, you know, who ostensibly couldn't find other employment, which wasn't true. And, you know, it was very paternalistic in a way and you know, a disgrace. And then he made a documentary about it, claiming to, you know, have a debate on all sides that really was a justification and a celebration. Dali Tambo was a celebration of himself. Dali himself was very disturbed about it when I spoke with him about it. So, you know, this is an example of PR, you know, and then Nelson Mandela dies. Elizabeth Freud, who is a well-known PR company, PR person representing Paul Simon, issued a statement about how much Nelson Mandela would be missed. I felt it was like the ultimate in hypocrisy. But leaving that aside, I mean, I don't think in the scheme of history, Paul Simon's ideas were accepted or embraced.
Not at all.
Now, his music may have been, you know, delighted. It was a hit. You know, he's a artist, no question. I would never, claim that he shouldn't have a right to his artistic expression. But there's much more to the story, as we tried to explain here. So, Prexy, you know, right now we have a few minutes left in this program, thinking about what's happening in South Africa, the shift here. Are we going to, you know, I can already see I'm going to be on Al Jazeera on Sunday morning, commenting on the funeral early in the morning from South Africa. There's going to be a lot of coverage, and then it'll be over. And the networks will say, we did Mandela. Mandela's done. Okay. And will we be able to keep this idea alive? Because it's not just an idea about South Africa. It's an idea about solidarity of people in one country aligning themselves with people who are fighting for freedom in another country.
Well, you know, Danny, I got to go, but I want to just mention to you and your listening audience that we are doing that. We've got a wonderful new organization, an intergenerational organization that utilizes in-person organizing and social network organizing called the U.S. Africa Network. And we are doing a lot of work around climate issues and work around the growing militarization of the African continent. So the solidarity has not ended. As long as there's suffering, there are going to be some people in this world who, like Nelson Mandela, say, I must get involved with that. I can't look myself in the eye if I don't get involved and do what I can do.
Well, that's good news, and thank you so much for sharing that with us, Prexy, and I'm sure you'll be soldiering on here, you know, with this effort to inform people about, you know, the tremendous heritage and history that connects Africa to America. Of course, 12 Years a Slave has been nominated for a lot of awards. The Mandela movie was nominated for a Golden Globe, or Idris Elba was. This is you know, something that is very present in our culture,
right,
and very much something that people who are interested can access, the power of these dramas, the power of these stories, realize how much we didn't know about what was
That's
happening
right.
in our own country and what is still happening in our name around the world.
Right.
So,
Danny, thank you. It was great to be with you.
Thank you so much. Prexy Nesbitt in Chicago teaches at Columbia College there and has been a stalwart in terms of, you know, standing up for Africa and trying to convince Americans that we have a responsibility to be involved in Africa as well. Stuart Sender, I guess, left us. Stuart was one of the team of journalists on South Africa Now, which for 156 weeks told the story of South Africa through the eyes of South Africans. Very few Americans were actually reporters. It was mostly South Africans who told the story. And that program was, you know, credited with having had an impact in the changes that were to come in South Africa. Your view on all this, Polar, I know you weren't directly involved, but you're interested in it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm very interested in it, and I'll have to admit it's not, you know, something I have enough in my own mind of a knowledge base on, so I prefer to listen to the experts on this one. But, yeah, the whole thing has moved me, and I remember when the Sun City Project came out, and at that time, you know, it was news to me, and I needed to hear that, and everybody else, you know, of that generation listening to MTV. And I've got to say, you know, at a time when I've been feeling a fair amount of despair about my own Homo sapiens species, that it's real nice to, I guess, you know, have an idol, you know, one of the few idols that I've had since I was a child, you know, and that there's this guy out there, Nelson Mandela, who managed to do this incredible thing and then had the grace, you know, to handle it the way he did. And
which included stepping down after one term in office.
Yeah, I mean,
which included, you know, really attempting to engage all the sectors of South African society in this effort, whites, blacks, Indians, so-called colored people, young people, old people. I mean, it was an inclusive revolution and still is. And it's still going on, by the way. You know, South Africa has not achieved a place of, you know, perfection. Inequality is very deep there. Poverty is very pervasive there. Just today, a prominent activist in the anti-apartheid movement has called on the president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, to step down, saying that he's responsible for the, you know, lack of respect that South Africa enjoys in many parts of the world. Not Mandela, but South Africa.
Well, it's not even a full generation since the change happened. You know, it takes a number of generations for stuff like this to filter down into a cultural DNA. You know, there's a lot of torment in a community that's going to take a few generations to water down.
I just want to tell our listeners that this program will be available as a podcast at PRN-FM. I'll be showcasing it on my blog at newsdissector.net. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. The book I was telling you about, Madiba A to Z, has a website also, madibabook.com, M-A-D-I-B-A. Book.com. Madiba, of course, is the tribal name of Nelson Mandela. So thank you for being with us. We want to go out with a great song honoring Steve Biko, who was murdered in a police station in South Africa.